Good evening, one and all. Another week, another Tuesday, and another book and a chat with me, Barry, of course, your host. Well, got through Easter, got some nice weather finally. We'll say finally, we've had a bit, but it's definitely sort of more springy night now, and the flowers are out and everything. Pretty good going here, but I'm ready for another show. And well, my guess, what can I say? Let's first off say that we get a lot of these things you hear about people being born with a silver spoon in their mouth. Yeah, and the opposite, you know, selling your home and getting the magic beans and everything like that. So suddenly, selling the cow. What am I about selling it? Jack and the Beanstalk, of course, and stuff like that. You know, finding success when you climb a beanstalk, a hen that lays eggs and all this, gold eggs and stuff like that. But what about in real life? What about, you know, literally starting from the very, very bottom and then moving yourself to the top? What can you gain from the experience you're doing that? What can you learn as you go along? Well, my guest today, he's written a book about his life and that sort of thing. With great pleasure, I'm going to introduce him. On the show today, I have the one and only Ed. Hey, Jim. Hi, Ed. How you doing?
I'm doing good.
It's great to have you on the show, Ed. Fancy not forgetting Jack and the Beanstalk. I tell you, old age is terrible. I was going through all the nursery rhymes in my head before.
Worse,
I tell you, it is. Anyway, Ed, as I said, you know, you far from being born with a silver spoon in your mouth, you sort of started way at the bottom of the barrel, so to speak, and your life, I mean, it's amazing, and you tell this story in your book, not just this story, but also the sort of how the lessons learned, because, was it age of three, you were actually kidnapped?
Yeah, my mother and father got divorced. Dad, it was in the middle of the Depression, 1936, mm-hmm. 1933, excuse me, and 1933 was when they were married. I was born in 36, and 3 years later, in 1939, they got divorced, and she was only 24 years old, and he didn't show up at the proceedings, but she got custody of me. We were living in Los Angeles, and she moved me back to her hometown, which was St. Louis, and she wasn't terribly welcome there because she was one of six siblings, and it was, the middle of the Depression, and so that they didn't need two more mouths to feed.
Exactly,
I was in St. Louis for a couple of weeks, and my father got $5 a week alimony and visiting rights on Sunday, and according to him, he arrived for his first visit and found me somewhat unkept. So instead of taking me to the movies or taking me to the playground, he got back on Highway 66 and took me back to Los Angeles, told my mother not to look for us, and then a few weeks later, which I don't remember, but he told me my mother had passed away and she died, and I would never see her. I never saw a picture of her.
Wow.
So that was the beginning of an odyssey, a 15-year odyssey, until I got to be 18 years old, which was quite a trip. I lived in 15 different places during that period of time. The first couple of years, Dad was a merchant marine. He was away part of the time, so I lived with a neighbor. Mm-hmm. But when we were together, we were buddies, and it was really great. And then, of course, Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
He either volunteered or was drafted as a merchant marine officer. He was 41 years old into the service, and I didn't see him for 4.5 years. And he, although we were Jewish, he put me at a Catholic welfare agency, so I spent the next 4.5 years in 5 different foster homes and 5 Catholic schools, which are kind of unusual. But that, and then after the war, he landed on the East Coast, and so I flew back there, a five-stopper, DC-10, 20 hours,
yeah.
Los Angeles to New York. We lived in a YMCA on 34th Street for a month and a half, and I learned the city while Dad was looking for land-based work. And then we went to Coney Island. I lived in a room and a half for a year, and Dad couldn't find any land-based work, so he went back to sea, and I ended up in 2 Jewish orphanages until I was 18.
Well, because, I mean, one of the things that obviously springs to my mind, in the turmoil that was your life, yet you were still, when you were with your dad, you were happy.
Well, one thing wonderful writing this book, and I was forced into writing it by my daughter and my wife and my 2 sons, and the University of Rochester. They all ganged up on me about 7 years ago and said, we've got to have this story. And I said, no, I want to keep it. I buried it when I was 18.
Right.
No, but now that writing it, I find it has two sides to it. You know, going up like I did, and just picture yourself going from one Catholic school to the other. You have a rites of passage in each one of those. You learn wonderful thing called adaptability.
Yes.
You learn to adapt. You know, you find out who you can beat up and who beats up you, you know, in the school
yard. Yep.
You find your place in the crowd. You find out whether you're the smartest kid in the school or the dumbest kid in the school. And you learn that. You learn adaptability. So I learned, you know, in my work life and in my personal life, I'm pretty adaptable. I mean, I've seen it all, so I don't get too concerned, and I just sort of go forward. I also found somehow I became a concept conceptually. I didn't become a victim. I always looked ahead. You know, people become a victim, and they start spiraling. Oh, my.
Yeah.
I just kept going forward. So you get that. And also you build resilience.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a muscle, you know, if you use it enough times. And obviously, as a child, not knowing what I was doing, I always continued to be resilient. Some of the foster homes were not terrific in those days because people took you because they needed the money.
Mm.
And they also get perseverance. You just keep going. And then long term, there's a really big positive development. You have empathy. When I interviewed people, I was a CEO of a company, I could empathize with a kid who was raised like me.
Mm.
And I could get, you know, empathize with. And then finally what you get basically long term is really gratitude. People say, you know, I'm 84 years old. Yes, how are you? I said, I'm grateful.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I woke up this morning. That's what I say.
Yes, yeah. No. I'm also grateful for the life that I've led. I've been very, very lucky. I said, at one point in time, I didn't have a home. Now, at one point in time, I had three of them. You know. So.
No, but I understand that. I mean, I sort of had, you know, quite a few people on the show have written books about, you know, make your life better and stuff like that. And I think to myself, well, I don't know. What can I say? Have I left my mark on this world? You know, have I made a difference to somebody along the way? And I say, yeah, I guess I have. What more can you ask for? You know?
No. That's, I mean, I in fact, is the marks you leave, you'd be surprised. Everybody, you know, I divide life into four parts: self, which you got to solve somewhere in the first 25 or 30 years; family, which comes along pretty quickly; then work; and then finally community. You know, work we give too much time to. We don't give enough time to family, and if we're not lucky enough, we don't get a chance for community. But, you know, I worked for three major firms: E.F. Hutton, Lehman Brothers, and Firman Sells, all three investment banks. They're all gone.
Yeah.
So you didn't leave my mark there. But, you know, big involved in the University of Rochester, where they named a school after me.
Oh, crikey.
You know, isn't that wonderful? Man?
Yeah.
The Hageum School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Do you realize there are 500 kids every year that go out into the world that have the same trouble I do with pronouncing my name? That's great. I mean, I have been Hajim. Most of it sounds much better, but it's Hajim or Ahim if you drop the H, you know. So, and these kids have to pronounce my name correctly. So that's a really a big plus. And that school will be there for probably for 100 years or more.
That's great.
That's a wonderful thing.
And everybody will remember it.
Yeah,
who's left it?
You know, I wasn't in the school. They named a quadrangle after me. And I am the first person in my entire neighborhood to have a statue.
Wow.
The president decided to build this, I mean, 8 foot of bronze.
Wow.
I can't believe it. They haven't done too much to it yet. They put a hat on it. They put a mask on it. They haven't done anything awful to it yet.
It's not been pulled down yet. At least that's something
no,
this day and age.
I was going to say, one of these days, I'm going to get it pulled down. But George Eastman and I both have statues.
Right.
There, so, I mean, I am so blessed by this whole thing. It was a great experience. I spent, you know, 30 years as a trustee, and we did the last experience. We raised a lot of money and changed the school to some extent.
Right.
So, you know, those are legacies that you can't get, and lucky. I mean, it's a great experience to have been able to do that. And what you said was very important. If you leave your mark, and the reason I'm on this book idea, if I can help a few young people, and I've been lecturing young people now for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and I'm finding the letters I'm getting back, and they're really resonating with me. If I can help them kind of smooth out those early bumps or even eliminate some of those early bumps, then I've done something. And
exactly.
So that's why,
exactly.
That's worthwhile, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, in your book, On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom, as you said, you know, you started off like that and you've traveled. Just the fact of a Jewish child being put in a Catholic school is hard to get your head round in a way. I mean, that must have been apartment, all the different places.
I didn't know I was Jewish.
Okay.
That's it. But when I was 9 years old, I wrote a letter to my father saying, have you got my baptismal certificates? I want to do my first communion because I want to be a good Catholic. It's a letter in the book. I mean.
Oh, my goodness.
My poor father, he didn't know what to do. So I'm probably the only guy in the world was both baptized and bar mitzvahed.
Oh, great. The fact and the different places you went to, you know, the different places you stayed at, and obviously these early days are a struggle, like you said, you know, with the families and everything like that. The experiences, good and bad, must have definitely sort of aided you, you know, like some of the ones you were saying, in later life when it came to the business world or it came to that sort of thing.
You know, I talk to people who raise their children like I have in very good communities, and I say to them, make your children a little uncomfortable. Send them out to Outward Bound or the Knowles in a National Outdoor Leadership School. I sent my daughter down to the Baja for 6 weeks in a canoe, and my grandson spent 30 days in the rain in Alaska. Because if you don't have, you know, you don't overcome things when you're young, and when you get older and you get to be real circumstances where you get into a business situation, which is very difficult, if you haven't overcome things, you get big anxieties. You're nervous about it. But, you know, what you go through what I went through, you know, I can't say that, disadvantages do become advantages, and I can't say it's a blessing being, you know, poor and so forth. But it did help a lot in a lot of situations, you know, and I did appreciate things a lot more than other people.
Yeah, I mean, and not just appreciate, I'd have thought, Ed, I know that I can look at things different ways. In fact, I've had a manager said I wasn't just, I'm not just thinking outside the box. I was raised outside the box. You know, because you look for other, you don't just look for the norm and take it for granted. Because you've been and done things, because you've looked at stuff, perhaps, you know, this stick line on the floor isn't just a stick, you know, it's the Tommy gun that's going to allow you to catch your friend's camp and imagination. And I think being able to look at that different view helps you in the business world as well.
I raised my hand when I was at Hutton. Nobody wanted to go to Japan. I'd never been to Japan.
Right.
And we didn't have anything in Japan. I raised my hand. I went to Japan. And then Lehman Brothers. Me, when I was a youngster, I was in business school. You know, people, I was in Nicaragua. They wanted me to, somebody wanted to fly to the East Coast to visit a company. Mm-hmm. And I went with three, you know, I was on the airplane. It was only four of us on the airplane. The pilot in Spanish says to me, if we crash, they don't look for us. The jungle is too thick.
Great, nice.
But I did it because it was something I was not afraid of change.
You've got to be able to face it.
That's a gift. You know.
Yeah, it is. Too many people are afraid of change, you know, be it personal or be it business or be it, you know, just how the world is. There, sure, change is bad, change is good. It's how you look at it, how you use it, and how you react to it, I think.
You're absolutely right. In fact, this book is a complete change for me because I spent my life under the mantra to live happy is to live hidden. Because on Wall Street, I always felt that publicity was the next step before jail. So I always stayed out of the press. I stayed out of TV. I'm not on any social media. And now I am because of the book. I mean, people tell me, you got to do this, you got to do that. But it's a real change for me. And, you know, my wife says, you're ready for it? I said, I think so. But I mean, but it's, you know, talking to people like you in the public like I'm doing now and, you know, telling my story. I never told my story. If I was 18 years old, I decided to bury it and bring it forward, you know. And then when I was 55 years later, they kind of put the lien on me. I found, I sent the galleys out.
Yeah.
And people said, you got to tell this to more people. You just can't hide it with your family. It might help some people. And it's really opened some new avenues for me. I discovered a group in Boston that deals, they have 72 kids who grew up in foster homes. They're in fine universities, and they counsel them.
Wow.
So obviously I become involved with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I can say I've been there, done that.
Yeah, exactly.
The problem with kids is their freshman year.
Yeah.
You know, they get there. It's not academics. It's social adjustment.
Totally different way of life, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you go there and you look around and you're so different than everybody else. And now it's a little different. There are, you know, when I got there, there wasn't anybody like me at all at the school. Maybe there was one other kid. But today they have, you know, 8 or 10 kids in the same sort of, type of kids. It's possible to sort of relate a little bit. Yeah. But anyway.
When you were writing your book, and you sort of, you know, you were thinking back to things and stuff like that. Did you find you know, some things that you buried in your memory for you didn't want to face it or something like that? Did you come across that sort of
thing? I think you've done this before. That is a great question, because it was one of the things that I struggled with this for 7 years, and mainly because of that. First of all, you know, when you start to write things, you got to look down and say, this is what I really mean? Will the people understand what I'm saying?
Right.
And the second thing, exactly, I had to separate facts from things that I remembered. I had to go back and read letters and make sure that I got things right. But as you said, I had a hell of a time. In fact, my daughter, I gave up finally. My daughter wrote the first 18 years of my life, because she did a couple of the writings. I just couldn't handle it, because things I didn't want to remember.
Right.
Then, most importantly, I came to a better comfortability with my relationship with my father. You know, I found things in there that, you know, I understood him better. I mean, I understand what he had to go through and what he tried to do and couldn't do, given the, you know, when you feel he lost everything from 29 to 33, everything, and he had been a very successful man. And I find in my lifetime, when people lose even a little bit, they have trouble adjusting.
Yeah.
He lost everything.
Yeah.
And then he lost his wife. And then he couldn't get a job.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think he did a good job of living his life out.
Right.
And so, but I didn't at the time. I mean, he died suddenly, and we were estranged. We wrote, he visited me, you know, it was a peaceable coexistence, but, you know, it wasn't warm and it wasn't good. So, and I had this, for the first time in my life, I actually went and got help.
Right.
For anybody that ever has a parent that dies suddenly, the woman that worked with me, she made me write letters to my father.
Oh.
And me write letters back, and she critiqued them, and I did it for 6 months.
Wow!
You know, to try to
what
go through
great
all
way.
The questions. It's a great. I mean, I never heard of that before, but
right.
I finally did. But anyway, yeah, you're right. The book, I had to separate facts. I had to find out what I was really saying, and there were parts that were very difficult for me to write. And also, in today's world, some things you can't say anymore.
Yeah. Oh, crikey, tell us about it. Tell me about it. I was still talking to some. A couple of people last week, we were talking about stuff and how things have changed. No,
no.
Yeah.
No.
How am I still alive with the stuff we used to do?
I think you're losing something now. You're losing really a flavor of things.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things we did back then may not have been the greatest things in the world, but be able to talk about them
would be
very healthy for everybody.
Exactly.
It was very different back there. Now you just mumble something. I'll give you an example, and I hope you're a listener. One of my roommates before I arrived at Harvard went over to the admissions office and said, you know, I made it very clear that I didn't want to live with a foreign student. So they said, no, he's not a foreign student. He's a naval officer. You know, he lives in Los Angeles, not a problem, and blah, blah, blah. Well, this particular person, I couldn't possibly mention that because he has a very high, he's in a very important jobs today, and I couldn't use his name.
Right. So, just how it is, isn't it?
But he laughed about it. He said, but Ed, you know, probably not a good idea to mention my name.
So, exactly.
And other things like that.
Yeah. In your book, On the Road Less Traveled, one of the things you do share is the four P's.
Yep.
Which is passion, principles, partners, and plans. So how do they work, Ed?
Well, see, I did this in 70 graduate. I gave 70 graduation talks, and so you have to have something you sort of stick with. And
yeah.
What I came with, I reviewed my life, and I said, what did I base my decisions on? And it was really finding my passions, and passions is an overused word. You know, it's talents, interests, you know, things you want to do. Then you pile that on top of your principles, starting off with the golden rule. There's a second golden rule, which is he who has the gold rules. Everybody's got to decide somewhere early in their life how much of their time they want to spend on, you know, obtaining financial resources, and that's important. But there are a lot of principles you go through, and I found them very important. A principle which was the secret to my management was basically I really believed that if you really want people to do better than they think they can, your management job becomes very easy. People feel you're trying to help them. And then you define your passions, define your principles, find your partners, and I found you're only as good as the people you surround yourself with.
Yeah.
And I found I failed when I had no partners or the wrong partners, and I succeeded when I had the right partners. Then make your plans. Now, I know man plans and God laughs, But you have to have a plan in order to know where you thought you were going so that you can change. And then right. In my plans, I spend a lot of time thinking about the period of history in which I live and what's going to go on during that period and try to catch a wave or a trend or a cycle or an unsatisfied need or latent demand, something that allows me to get my wind at my back.
Yeah.
And I find most people that are successful, sometimes they don't give credit for it, but it's many, many times it's because you found you were at the right place at the right time. And thinking about that works. But you have to find your passions and your principles, because you may decide your passions is going to be in a business where your wind is in your face at all times.
Right.
A good friend of mine does back surgery in Ethiopia.
Wow.
He hasn't got the wind in his back. It's a tough, tough job.
Right.
He's chosen that and he knows it. But I find that if you develop that language with yourself and use it over a lifetime, I have little yellow pads that go through, and your passions change. Mine started, math and science, baseball and basketball, and that morphed into engineering, and then finally it morphed into management. And my sports merged into intramurals finally, and then extracurricular activities.
Mm.
So it all, those things, and principles change too. The most important principle, today in my life today is gratitude.
Right.
I mean, I really want to say thank you to as many people as I can, because that's another thing I learned. Again, you great, great question. I learned in the book, I always felt I did a lot of this myself.
Right.
When I started to write the book, I found out there was a woman in one of the foster homes. She was fabulous. So she really showed me what a home was like.
Mm-hmm.
There was a kid at the orphanage, Rick Saffron, who took me under his wing. There was a professor in my first year. I would have flunked out because I couldn't do mechanical drawing, but he helped me get through mechanical drawing.
Wow.
So I had a lot of these people all through my life who helped me, so that in many respects, I didn't do it myself. I had a lot of good mentors and people who helped me and so forth. So that, and then giving credit. So
right.
That's another reason you should be grateful.
Indeed.
That's the four pieces. I really want people, I truly believe there's only one constant in life, and that's your inner voice.
Yeah.
You're talking to yourself. And if you develop a good language, I'm not saying those four P's can be something else, just a constant language, so you can go back to that and say to yourself, remember what you said about the passions? Is it true today? Have they changed?
I think that's some
principles.
I think that's
a principle.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's something that people don't do. They might set goals, and that's it. But they don't go back. They don't go back and listen to themselves. They don't sort of review themselves to make and check over their accomplishments and stuff like that. They have a goal they set out with, and that's it. And you don't.
Exactly. They have a goal, and also they don't realize what they base that goal on.
Right.
Because you got to go back and look at it. What was I thinking about that point in time? Was I the same person?
Yeah.
They've been very different. And if I'm going to change, make sure I understand why I'm changing. But it's a methodology, and I find that each person, focuses on a different element of the PI. When I gave the talk at graduation, a couple of parents wrote me and said, we argued all the way back which is the most important P. And that was a good discussion, because
right.
I think they're all important. But, there is a more important. For some people, they automatically pick the right partner. Some people have, their passions are well established. And some people have to work hard on their principles. I mean,
yeah.
Principles to me are, the idea that early in your life, you really make a decision on what lines you won't cross. When you come to those lines, you don't cross them.
Mm.
And,
yeah.
And that's, you early in, and by the way, the same old problem when you cross a line and you fail. Failure, by the way, is a gift if it comes early. And that's why
I learn from your mistakes, go
back and review your four P's,
yeah.
Why did I fail? Well, I
yeah.
picked the wrong partner, or I crossed the line I shouldn't have crossed, or, this really wasn't something I was interested in. I did it for the money,
right.
And that's, that's what the four P's are all about.
I've got another book coming. Oh, I was going to say, on the success on this with the On the Road Less Traveled, you've now got another book coming out, you say?
Yeah, it's going to be focused on the four P's.
Okay.
I'm going to really expand the four P's. But I have it was the first book that I wrote, and then a woman came along and said she thinks I ought to do my autobiography first, and I worked for her for 18 months, and then that didn't work out, and it took me 7 years to. My present ghostwriter said, Ed, I could have written the Bible while you. you were working on your bloody book.
Okay, so, obviously you've had a huge amount of response from, On the Road Less Traveled, and I was also looking through reviews and stuff like that, and a lot of people said it's the sort of book that every school should have, to show people, especially, yeah, like you said, you've spoken to graduates and stuff like that. People started out on their life. I mean, I think this is a definite good grounding for that sort of thing.
Well, that's let me give you a quick list here. You know, the book says, and that's why I think everybody's saying that. The young high school graduates, call it young college kids, anything, it shows anything is possible. You know, this guy, when I was 14 years old, I was 4'11 and I weighed 80 pounds, okay? And I was in an orphanage, you know, so anything's possible. Education is the solution to everything, or almost everything. It's, if possible, find a partner, somebody you can share your life with. There are different partnerships these days, but it's a fine one. And don't, surround yourself with good people as much as you can.
Yeah.
And then try to find your passions and pay attention to how they change. You know, those things, those lessons in there, everybody will interpret it differently, and I'm getting a wonderful response on people saying they relate to their own lives, which gives me a feeling the book is getting through.
That's definitely, that's all you can ask for, all you can ask. Well, I know all we can ask for is the great conversation we've had with you, Ed, but what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where people can find more about you and, of course, your books.
Well, you go to Amazon or Simon & Schuster, both of them lay out, they've done a very good job. Don't get caught up in the fact that it says, On the Road Less Traveled, number one bestseller. That's, unfortunately, it put me in an unusual category. It put me in the category of Syrian travel guides. I'm a number one bestseller.
Oh, my goodness, that's a great one.
Number one is something, I'm number one is something. If you want to find out more about me, which I'm not excited about, but I've finally given away to it, www.edhagem, I'm the only one in the world, there's another one, .com. My publicist, who's a wonderful lady, has done a very brilliant job of laying out, my life and so forth. She's done a good job. There's one section on gratitude there. I have 11 elements of gratitude. So www.edhagem, HAJIM.com. But the book can be bought on Amazon. There are now over 60 reviews.
Great.
So you can find one you can relate to. I've been very lucky that people have been willing to review it. And if you're going to give me 5 stars, I'd appreciate it if you would review it too.
Okay, Ed, well, thanks so much for being
hey,
a
Barry,
guest.
Thank you. Thank
been
you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, there you go. My guest today, Ed Hajim. That's H-A-J-I-M. Hajim. And been talking about his great book, and it is really interesting and very useful to a lot of people, in fact everybody, I think, On the Road Less Travelled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. Or, as we just heard, it's also the number one bestseller on a Syrian travel guide. But I think it's more that we look at this other one. And the book, part of that, the 4 P's, passion, principle and partners and plan, which, as he said, bringing out in a more detailed book later on. Well, that's great. Well, tomorrow I'm not here for a live show. We'll have an old show playing. I've actually got an appointment in the hospital tomorrow, but got that. But I'll be back on Sunday with Those Are the Days, music from the 20th century. And this is our last one of our One Hit Wonders. And that's from 5 to 6pm Eastern. Then from 6 to 7pm Eastern on Sunday, I'll be with you again with the Swinging 60s. Music from the 60s. Not just the British Invasion, but from all around the world. Well, until then, as always, we've got one thing left to say. Don't forget...